From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, higher consciousness.
Are you conscious now?
Well, I think so. At least I hope so.
Good. Well, we'll come back to that. But very often, if you just go up to somebody, and which I tend to do, and just poke them and go, hey, are you conscious now? And they go, yes. And get this very strange feeling that something has changed because I asked the question. And you can do it to yourself. And you suddenly think, it's almost a bit like waking up. Almost a bit like you've just become conscious because you asked the question.
So what does it mean to wake up, to become conscious, to experience transcendence? Today, we'll talk with some of the world's leading experts on consciousness. Scientists, contemplatives, religious thinkers. I'm guessing by now you've heard all about the benefits of meditation, how it can relieve stress, help you feel centered, even make you more compassionate. So if it's that beneficial, shouldn't we teach kids the art of mindfulness?
Your teachers invited me to come in here to teach you some things. So what we're going to learn about is a brand new word maybe for some people. It's called mindfulness. Can you say that?
Mindfulness.
Two important things happen with mindfulness.
This is a preschool class of 4 and 5 year olds, not far from our studio in Madison. The woman you hear is not their regular teacher. She's a certified meditation teacher.
The other thing about mindfulness is when you pay attention, what happens to your body? It gets slow. So the first thing we're going to do today is pay attention on the inside. Is everybody ready? So I brought something. Who knows what that is? Will?
A bell.
We're gonna listen. And when the bell stops, when you can't hear it anymore, raise your hand. Ready?
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson wants to bring the art of mindfulness into our schools. He's one of the world's leading experts on the science of mindfulness. He's teamed up with the Dalai Lama to put Buddhist monks in his brain scanning machines. And he's developing a new scientific model for studying emotion. But when Davidson was a Harvard grad student back in the 70s, cognitive science ruled, and hardly anyone thought emotions were worth studying. Richie Davidson kept pursuing his interest in the science of emotion, and as he tells Steve Paulson, his scientific work ended up changing his life.
I wanted to study emotion because I had this kind of inner conviction that emotion was really the key to so much that was important about human behavior. We inevitably resort to language that includes emotion. A person is friendly, or they're grumpy, or they're cheerful. It just struck me that emotion was key to understanding our personality.
Now, you write about something else that happened back in the 70s when you were living in the Boston area. Some of your circle of friends were involved in meditation, and that somehow seemed to hit home for you.
That was a very important influence, and these are all people who had been to India. When I first met these guys, they struck me as being extraordinarily kind, gentle, humble people, and it was their demeanor that impressed me most, not the content of what they were talking about, but just who they were as people.
So you ended up going off to India and Sri Lanka to study meditation, right, as well as to do it.
I did. I left at the end of my second year of graduate school, much to the consternation of some of the faculty at Harvard who thought that either I was going off the deep end or B, that I would never return.
What did you do over in Sri Lanka and India?
Well, in Sri Lanka, I was able to meet people who are contemplatives, who've spent their life training their mind and familiarizing themselves with their mind. Of course, the word meditation comes from the Sanskrit root, which in part means familiarization. These are people who were utterly familiar with the operation of their own mind in ways that I think are not common in the West because they've just spent so much time doing it. I then went off to India and had my first taste of intensive meditation practice. And this is kind of like meditation boot camp where we're in retreat in complete silence and meditating for, you know, more than 12 hours a day. It's very difficult to go through an experience like that and not really feel that your mind can be powerfully affected.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that your interest in the science of the mind, the science of mindfulness, has very personal roots.
It does have very personal roots. And, you know, I became involved in psychology and neuroscience because I was convinced that if people can transform their mind, we can actually make the world a better place.
Hmm. But again, it sounds like you were challenging a fundamental idea about neuroscience, which is that, well, the mind is just what the brain does. In fact, I went to a talk not that long ago with a prominent neuroscientist, and he was asked, so what is the mind? And his definition was, the mind is what the brain does. That's not exactly your position, is it?
No, it's not exactly my position, although I still would describe myself as saying that were it not for the brain, we wouldn't have a mind. Mm-hmm. However, having said that, I also would say that we can change our brain by transforming our mind. The involvement that I've had with the meditative traditions has convinced me that we should regard qualities like kindness and compassion and equanimity and happiness and well-being, for that matter, really as the product of skills that can be nurtured through training.
But I just want to follow up on this early point because it sounds like a really radical idea that mental activity alone can change the brain, can actually change the physical structure of the brain.
I think at that time it was a radical statement, unquestionably. And the amazing thing is now I think that the majority of neuroscientists would agree with it.
Now, I'm willing to bet that people who have read about you in the popular press actually know you best because of your work with the Dalai Lama and with a number of Buddhist monks. And I know this has been important to you personally. Can you take me back to the first time you met the Dalai Lama?
I met him for the first time in the fall of 1992 at his residence in Dharamsala, India. And I was in India as part of a small scientific team that he wished to encourage to investigate the minds and brains of advanced meditation practitioners who were practicing in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It was a very special moment. I was the spokesperson for this group of four, and when you go in to meet the Dalai Lama, you know, you have to go through certain security. He's considered a head of state. And I'm not a person who I'd consider to be very high anxious, but in the period where just after we were searched, I nearly had a panic attack, and it was because I could not envision how I was going to start the conversation. I just reflected, you know, here I was about to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I was flooded with all of this self-doubt. Why am I here? Who am I to be wasting the Dalai Lama's time? And we were ushered into a room, and the Dalai Lama came in, you know, maybe 15 seconds after we were ushered into the room. And palpably, within less than 1 minute, all of my anxiety was completely and utterly and totally gone. And not only was my anxiety gone, but I felt more secure and more content than I had felt in a long, long time.
So what happened in that first minute?
You know, the Dalai Lama has an amazing presence, and he walked in, made some joke, and started laughing, and just instantaneously, he has, I think, an extraordinarily skillful way of seeing suffering in others. And he clearly, I'm sure, saw that I was very uncomfortable. And this was a way that he spontaneously and just with enormous facility completely dissipated.
Now, you've written that that first meeting with the Dalai Lama has had a tremendous impact on your life. It changed your life, both in a career sense and also in a personal sense. What happened? How did things go in a different direction after that?
Well, he at one point in the conversation really challenged me, and he said, you know, you've been using the tools of modern neuroscience to study things like fear and disgust and depression and anxiety. And he said, why can't you study kindness? Why can't you study compassion? Huh. And, you know, it was a really pivotal moment.
Had you thought about that before?
Not really. You know, it just was so outside the scientific worldview. Nobody studied kindness and compassion who was a real scientist. You know, by that time in my career, in 1992, I was a full professor and, you know, I had begun to get some awards in my career. And I felt that I would be a coward if I really didn't step up to the plate. But it wasn't, you know, the fear of being a coward that motivated me. It was really the wish to get back to my roots. And I wanted to get in this business in the first place to help people.
So that, among other things, led you to studying various Buddhist monks. I mean, experienced meditators who'd spent thousands of hours, in some cases, meditating to actually bring them into your lab, into your MRI machines.
Yes, it directly led to that. And so I made a commitment to His Holiness on that day that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion on the scientific and specifically the neuroscientific map, and that one of the ways that we would do it is to begin to seriously study long-term practitioners.
What's been the most important thing you've learned from those studies?
We haven't even begun to approach the limits of human neuroplasticity. It's been a humbling experience to work with these long-term practitioners to get a glimpse of the depth in which we can actually change our brain and do that through changing our mind, transforming our minds. That has been really an extraordinarily powerful opportunity to learn that.
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson runs the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin, and he's the co-author with Sharon Begley of The Emotional Life of Your Brain. You'll find Steve's extended interview with Richie Davidson, along with a complete transcript, on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. One of those Buddhist monks who's had his brain scanned is a Frenchman named Mathieu Ricard, who gave up a career in biochemistry to become a monk. He has spent literally thousands of hours meditating. Some scientists have called Ricard the happiest man in the world, which is a nice personality trait to fall back on when you're having a bad day.
No, in India, those travel can last for 24, 48 hours. So once I came to a train and I was going very far away, there was a completely broken wagon with all the windows broken. I sat there on a wooden bench. I put my laptop on the above the seat in a well-protected place, and somehow someone, I guess with a wire or something, had pulled out my laptop and stolen it away. And then I had a terrible back pain. And then at 11 o'clock, the light went off, and all the other passengers were putting chains in their luggage out of fear that they would be stolen. And then suddenly in that darkness with this back pain and everything gone, I sort of felt so good. I felt this sort of inner peace and serenity to the point that I started laughing because the outer condition was so horrible. And I felt extremely peaceful and joyful and serene and satisfied. I suddenly had a glimpse that really it depends upon your state of mind. When you feel extremely angry and therefore very disturbed, you are anger. But then, instead of doing that, you look at anger as if you were looking at a fire burning or at a volcano, and you look and look at it. And now what will happen? You look at anger as a phenomena. And then as you look at it, it's sort of melting away, like the morning frost under the rising sun. It just vanishes and disappears. We feel that there is extraordinary potential in every human being. It's not just like a wishful thinking, because if we look in the nature of consciousness, like introspectively, of course there are the screen of thoughts, of positive and negative thoughts, but beneath that, there is a kind of aspect of pure consciousness that allows every thought to arise, and like the surface of a mirror that allows all kinds of images to come. And therefore, you can act on the causes and conditions that change your mental landscape. We are born with certain traits. People are more or less joyful, more or less depressed. But it's just a blueprint. Even our genetic inheritance is a blueprint. You know, if you don't do anything about it, then mostly it will follow its own course. But the point of mind training is that gradually, with diligence, you change the landscape of your mind, and so as to acquire the quality that brings you this deep sense of well-being.
A few thoughts from Buddhist monk Mathieu Ricard. Are kids hardwired to believe in God? Coming up, the science of religious belief. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Higher Consciousness, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Think back to when you were a little kid. Did you think there were spirits or supernatural beings you couldn't see? Psychologist Justin Barrett says most children do. In fact, he thinks kids have a natural aptitude for religious belief. Barrett's the author of a book called Born Believers, The Science of Children's Religious Belief.
Children come into the world with lots of tendencies or biases or dispositions to make sense of the world around them in particular kinds of ways. We're not just blank slates. Once I started connecting the dots, it sure looks like a lot of those natural dispositions encourage certain kinds of religious beliefs. So, for instance, unless we get educated out of it, we have a natural tendency to see features of the natural world as here for a purpose, for a reason. They seem to have design. And, well, that's pretty easy to connect up with a designer, someone who is responsible for that purpose or that design.
You think that we're born with a desire to ask not just why, but for what purpose?
Well, I think that's right. Children do naturally ask why. They can drive us crazy with their why questions, right? But also, they're attracted to certain kinds of explanations. In particular, they're attracted to what you might call intentional explanations. That is, someone brought this about, or someone intended it for it to be thus, or someone has caused this to happen. Now, I'm not suggesting that babies on their own, when they're 12 months old, are looking around and they see a tree and they go, I wonder if God made that. But it does seem to be the case that very young children look at the things around them, like trees and mountains and rivers, and wonder, what's it for? And they very quickly connect what's it for, these purposes and functions, with someone intended it for a particular reason. And so then if they're introduced to the idea of there being gods or other spirits and things that might account for this, they just find that very intuitive and sensible.
I guess what I'd like, because you've done research into this, is to have an example or two. You've studied young children who have found belief in the supernatural of one kind or another easy. Can you tell me about them?
One example I like to share, because I think it's easy to follow, is a task that's called a false belief task. And this is done with children sort of around the age of 3 to 6 years old. And the task goes like this. You present a child with a familiar container, like a cracker box, for instance. And you ask, what kind of box is this? And of course, they're not dumb. They can see the picture of crackers. It's a cracker box. That's right, it is a cracker box. What do you think's inside the box? Well, I think there are crackers in the box. And then you show the children that what's inside the box is actually rocks or some other surprising content. Say, look, I took the crackers out and I put rocks in this box. Now I'm going to close it back up so you can't see what's inside of it. No one can see what's inside of it. What's in the box? Rocks. That's right, there are rocks in the box. And now this is where the fun part starts. We ask, now suppose your mother came in and saw this box for the first time. What would your mother think is inside the box? People have done these tasks dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And the typical pattern is your five-year-old child will say, well, mom would think there are crackers in the box. She'd be fooled by the appearance of the box, and she'd think there are crackers in it. But three-year-olds say rocks. Mom would think there are rocks in the box.
Development of critical reasoning is what you're talking about.
This is taken as a task of understanding that beliefs don't necessarily map onto the world out there, but people can get stuff wrong. The reason I'm interested in this task is because there are some peoples, allegedly, who don't get things wrong, and that would be certain kinds of gods. God, of course, would know that there are rocks in the box at any age. But the conventional wisdom is that for the youngest child, they can't understand that God might have super knowledge. God is just some human, maybe who lives up in the clouds or something like that. So we ask three-year-olds, what would God think is in the box? We ask four-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds, what would God think is in the box? And at least with some of our samples that we've looked at, children at all ages say, God would think there are rocks in the box. What I think is kind of fun about this study is it shows a couple of things. One is very young children, preschool-age children already, can distinguish between what mom knows and what God knows. Okay? They can understand that mom would think there are crackers in the box, that God would think there are rocks in the box. The other thing it suggests is that they're actually getting God right before they're getting mom right. That is, the three-year-olds are right about what God would know, and they're wrong about mom. By the time they're five, they're getting mom right. In some ways, it's more of a developmental achievement to figure out mom's knowledge states than God's knowledge states. And that looks to me at least like some evidence that at least some divine attributes are actually easier for kids than we might think.
The natural question, I'm sure you've been asked this, is what would happen if you had a group of kids, if they could find enough to eat, stranded on an island, uninvolved with adults, would they end up believing in God?
Oh, that's a tough thought problem, right? Because they're bound to be screwed up in other ways, too. But I do think there is a good chance that they would discover for themselves certain ideas about gods.
They're predisposed to God no matter what their situation is.
Yeah, it might not look like the same kind of God that anyone else has come up with, but I do think, you know, if we ran this little experiment over and over again, if we got an ethics board to approve it, that on average we would find that these kids would come up with ideas of gods and that they would tend to be super knowing, super perceiving, immortal, and somehow involved with ordering or creating the natural world. I think that would come up again and again.
I know that many atheists come to a different conclusion about the evidence from your research. They think we become religious because we're indoctrinated. And in fact, their evidence is that most kids seem to adopt the same religious faith as their parents. You wouldn't suggest, would you, that parental influence is not involved in the way this is developed? You're just saying it starts in a different place?
That's right. I think of it as sort of the playing field is tilted towards religious belief or something like that. It's a little bit like language. Certainly, children tend to acquire the language of their parents. But it doesn't follow from that that they don't have natural propensities toward learning language.
So what do you think this says about atheism? Is that a decision we make to become atheists?
I think in many cases it is, frankly. This takes some intellectual work to pull this off in a consistent fashion. Which is one of the reasons why we don't see widespread atheism, frankly, except under very unusual cultural environments, environments in which there's lots of formal education, lots of ability to reflect on things like the apparent design in the world and to come up with counter explanations to the natural trend, which is someone did it. So yeah, I would say it takes special cultural resources, maybe a little bit of extra effort to be a thoroughgoing atheist.
But you are yourself a Christian, is that correct?
That's correct.
Also, from reading your book, I got the impression that you would agree there is no proof for God. And that's not really what you're talking about. You're talking about a propensity to believe there is.
That's right. The book is not an argument for the existence of God. That's not what it's about. I'm trying to provide scientific and other reasons for suspecting that we have natural receptivity to religious beliefs. What you do with that, whether you decide that makes a good argument against religious beliefs or for, well, that's a different intellectual exercise. I think that's an ongoing discussion.
Justin Barrett is a psychologist at Fuller Seminary and Oxford's Center for Anthropology and Mind. He's the author of Born Believers, The Science of Children's Religious Belief. Karen Armstrong is one of the world's best-known writers on religion, the author of a string of bestsellers from A History of God to the memoir The Spiral Staircase. Armstrong's own spiritual path has been anything but easy. When she was 17, she tried to find meaning in her life by joining a convent and becoming a nun. But as she tells Anne Strangechamps, that didn't work out.
I found it almost impossible to pray, which was clearly something of a drawback for a nun. I would go in the morning to make my morning meditation, and my mind would immediately go skittering off down all kinds of blind alleys of distractions and worries and fantasies, or else sunk into a kind of torpor of boredom.
But it's not just that the religious vocation didn't quite take in you. Reading about your experience in that convent, it can be kind of a painful experience. I mean, for instance, when you suffered repeated fainting spells, your superiors, rather than take you to the doctor, chastised you. It sounds like a kind of brutal regime.
Well, this attitude towards my health was a very much Victorian attitude. Fainting was regarded as a weakness of will, attention-seeking, and we were supposed to be strong women, not wilting Victorian ladies. I don't think it occurred to anybody to take me to a doctor. But indeed, once I'd left the religious life, I did go to doctors who were unable to diagnose my condition properly. I had temporal lobe epilepsy, but for years went to psychiatrists, none of whom thought of doing an EEG.
Did you still believe in God after you left the order, or did it all seem like a pack of lies?
No, I wouldn't have said I thought it was a pack of lies. God just drifted slowly away out of my life. He had never been there very much. I had a rather naive and I think uneducated idea of God. I wasn't expecting visions and voices, but I was expecting some kind of encounter with a being outside myself. And when that didn't happen, after a few years outside the religious life in the secular world, I just stopped going to church, and my belief in God, such as it was, just drifted away.
One of the most fascinating parts of this book, The Spiral Staircase, to me is the section when you write about how you began to write the book that became The History of God, your big breakout bestseller, and a book that really changed your life in many ways. Where did the idea for that book come from?
I had been working on a book on the Crusades, a television series that was actually never screened, about the hostile relations between the three monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it had been a very dispiriting and gloomy experience, really. And after the demise of the television series, I was walking up my little street with groceries. And I thought, well, you know, I've got to go do some kind of work. And maybe it would be good to do something a bit more positive. Instead of looking at what divides the three faiths, why not concentrate on something that connects them? And I thought, what about God? You know, they all believe in the same God. Why not write a history of the idea of that God? Once I started working on my God book, I was working alone. My television career had folded. There was nobody to make smart remarks to, or nobody to exclaim about the irrationality of some of these doctrines. And working in silence, my relationship with these texts slowly began to change. They began to enter my heart once clever, entertaining Karen had been put on the back burner.
What was it about silence, do you think, that made your encounter with religious texts fundamentally different than what it had been before?
At first, I resented the silence and the solitude. I thought, here I am, yet another career failure, shoved outside life, shoved out onto a limb in this peripheral position with nobody to talk to. But gradually, the silence started to become a dimension. It had its own texture that I could feel, and it began to orchestrate the words. It forced me to go into my inner world and relate the texts to myself in a way that I hadn't done before. And studying other traditions, this is very important, studying Judaism, Islam, Greek and Russian Orthodox Christianity, and finally Buddhism, gave me whole new perspectives on religion that I'd never had before in my very Catholic upbringing. And I began to see there was a lot out there that I could really relate to.
Did you begin to have some sort of encounter with the divine, some kind of direct mystical experience through spending time with these texts?
I'm not a mystic. What I find has happened is that occasionally when I'm reading these texts, I have little mini seconds of awe or wonder or ecstasy, almost just a soundless, oh, how beautiful. Hmm. I don't see God anymore as a personality. And indeed, what I was discovering when I was doing the research for the history of God was that the most eminent Jews, Christians, and Muslims had all pointed to the fact that our idea of God doesn't in any way measure up to the ineffable, indescribable, incomprehensible reality to itself. That there is, as Paul Tillich put it, a God beyond God. That our ideas of God are only meant to be a springboard to transcendence. And transcendence means going beyond, and it does go beyond concepts and doctrines and makes you rest in a kind of silence out there. And finding a silence within, this sacred realm of peace within, is also what people have called divine or nirvana or Brahman over the years.
It sounds as though the book you set out to write, the book that would debunk the God myth, gave you a version of God you could actually live with.
And indeed, it was picked up with great appetite by people in all three of the monotheistic religions who said, yes, this is our tradition, a tradition that has been lost in our more rational world when we rely too much on intellect and rationality, which is indispensable for medicine or mathematics or natural science, but no good for God any more than reason or extreme rationality can help us really understand the effect of a late Beethoven quartet upon us. We're talking about other, more intuitive forms of the mind. The great Muslim theologian Ibn al-Arabi, 12th century theologian, said that the chief religion organ is the creative imagination. Jean-Paul Sartre called the imagination the ability to think of what is not present. And so that is the chief religious faculty, as we endlessly try to envisage the eternally elusive divine.
Karen Armstrong, talking with Anne Strainchamps. Her many books include A History of God and the memoir The Spiral Staircase. Up next, will the internet become conscious? For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Higher Consciousness, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Could the internet feel happy or depressed? It's a distinct possibility, according to the pioneering neuroscientist Christoph Koch. He says the internet's developing a staggering level of complexity, maybe even comparable to the wiring of the human brain. Koch is the rare neuroscientist who speculates openly about all kinds of big questions: computer consciousness, God, and just what it means that our brains have 100 billion neurons and trillions of synapses.
It's not the sheer numbers of it. It's the incredible complex ways in which these things are wired up. And so that makes it different from a galaxy. Our Milky Way, for example, also contains 100 billion suns. But the way these suns interact is very, very simple compared to the way that neurons can interact with each other.
This is an important point to make. You're saying that it doesn't matter so much what the neurons are made of. It's how they're organized. How are they wired together? That's what counts.
Correct. So unless you believe in some magic substance that attached to our brain is some magic stuff, you know, that exudes consciousness, which certainly no scientists believe, then the only answer is, it's as you said, it's not the stuff the brain is made out of, but it's a relationship of that stuff to each other. So it's the fact that you have these neurons and they interact in very complicated ways. And in principle, if you could replicate that interaction, let's say in silicon on a computer, you would get the same phenomena, including consciousness.
So it's entirely possible that the internet could become conscious, or maybe it already is conscious.
In principle, that's possible. Correct. What matters for consciousness is the fact that you have these incredible complicated little machines, these little switching devices called nerve cells and synapses, and they're interbraided, they're wired up in amazingly complicated ways. And if you could mimic that, for instance, if the internet taken as a whole, you know, the internet already now has a couple of billion nodes, you know, each node is a computer. Each of one of these computers contains a couple of billion transistors. So yes, it is in principle possible that the complexity of the internet is such that it feels like something to be conscious. And depending on the exact state of the transistors on the internet, it might feel sad one day and happy another day, or whatever the equivalent is in internet space.
You're serious about using these words, that the internet could feel sad or happy?
What I'm serious about is that the internet, in principle, could have conscious states. Now, the exact meaning of these conscious states, do they express happiness? Do they express pain, pleasure, angry? That really depends exactly on the relationship of the transistors and of the nodes and of the computers to each other. But there's no question that in principle it could feel something, yes.
Would we humans recognize whether there are certain parts of the internet that are conscious, or is that somehow beyond our understanding?
Well, if suddenly it develops some autonomous behavior that nobody programmed into it, right, where people say, whoa, what just happened here? I mean, it just sort of self-organized in some really weird way. It wasn't a bug. It wasn't some botnet that was paid for by some, you know, nefarious organization, but it did it by itself. Yes, and if this happens on a regular basis, then I think at some point many people would say, yeah, I guess it in some sense it's alive and it may have conscious sensation.
You like these big philosophical questions, don't you?
You know, I think a lot about my place in the universe. What are we doing here? How do we come about? Does it mean anything? You know, usually you ask these questions when you're 18 and 19, and then you get on with the serious business of living. And I guess I still, even at my age, I still ask these questions because I want to know before I die. I want to know, you know, how it all fits together.
It's worth pointing out that you grew up a Roman Catholic, I mean, an observant Catholic, and I know you have kind of lost your faith in a personal God, at least, but it would seem that that search for meaning, that yearning for the absolute is still with you.
That's correct. that's very much correct. You know, I try to be guided by the current state of our science, but I also see these facts that we find ourselves in this universe that is very conducive to life, and this somehow has to be explained. I don't know how to explain it, but I see this this arrow, this sort of progress towards ever larger complexity and to ever larger consciousness. And I don't know what it means. I can't understand it, but I see it, I observe it, and I'm happy. I'm content about it.
It sounds like you're not exactly an atheist. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not a conventional atheist that believes it's all just random. It's just a random formation. That's correct. Although, as you said, I don't believe in a personal God and any of the standard things that you're supposed to believe in as a Roman Catholic or as a Christian in general. It's much closer, in fact, to Buddhist thought. I just grew up calling this thing God because that's my tradition, but it's not any God in any sense that we in the Western world would recognize it, I believe.
So do you look for meaning in the world of science?
I find meaning in the world of science. It's this incredible, beautiful, aesthetic thing. I mean, isn't it a wonder that we can understand the universe using mathematics that's comprehensible to our minds? That's just absolutely amazing. I mean, there's no law in the universe that says that it should be like that. That fills me with a great contentment, I must say. Yes, and science does that to me.
From reading your book, my sense is that you take this one step further. You talk about experiencing the numinous, you know, the transcendent. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's something more personal. I often feel I don't know. I find it very difficult to talk about. I can't really describe it. It's, yeah, I just feel I'm in a universe that's filled with meaning. I just see it everywhere. And I realize it's a psychological mindset. I fully realize other people don't have this. I have this. I think maybe I'm just more fortunate. It's difficult to explain, to put into words. You have this intense feeling of the beauty of the world. You don't know where it comes from, but you just have this very intense experience of it.
You know, it's so interesting hearing you talk about what I would call your spiritual side. I mean, given your credentials as a scientist and especially given your partnership with Francis Crick, one of the most famous scientists of the 20th century, who was also a famous atheist. Now, Francis Crick was what, 40 years older than you?
Yes, in fact, exactly. Correct.
And is it fair to say that he was your mentor?
Yeah, he was my we had this, you know, some sort of intellectual father-son relationship because the age difference, and we got along very well. It was a very intense experience.
What was that like, working with him? I mean, with someone who was so brilliant?
It was a sheer joy and pleasure. I mean, what happened so often that he would take the same facts that I would read, and he would just come to a startling new conclusion, right? I looked at the same facts, and I read the same paper, but then he made this jump, you know, because he connected these facts to some, let's say, to something he'd done early on in molecular biology. And sort of there he says, well, in molecular biology, we looked at these sort of facts from this point of view. So maybe we should look at these facts in the brain sciences from that point of view. And he was very, very good at that. Later on, he didn't sleep so well. So very often he would lie awake at night and think about things and come, you know, to breakfast table having great new ideas. And he wasn't afraid of continuously throwing out these ideas. Many of them were crazy. Many of them were, you know, interesting but didn't work. But occasionally there were these wonderful ideas. So he just generated, you know, per unit time so much more ideas than other people did.
Well, and as we've already said, the other piece of Francis Crick's story is that he was an ardent atheist. In fact, the story is that he actually left Churchill College in Cambridge because they went ahead and built a chapel over his objections. And you...
That's correct. I just visited it last week. I was just at Churchill College and I visited the chapel because of that story.
You have this background as a Catholic and, you know, you still have some sort of religious sensibility. Did you talk much about religion with Crick?
Yeah, we did. And in fact, he was gentle with respect to my faith. I mean, he knew I had some religious sensibilities quite well because we talked about it. But I guess sort of his ardor fighting against religious sensibility had cooled by the time I'd met him.
And did you ever push back? Did you ever challenge some of his atheist assumptions?
No. We once had a very interesting discussion about death. It's one of the things I greatly admire about him, not only that he was, you know, a genius and a great source of scientific inspiration for me, but also his attitudes towards getting old and dying. I had this debate with him about death where, you know, he knew he had very short to live because he had colon cancer that couldn't really be held in check. And every time I came there, we early on in the morning when I arrived there, we talked a little bit about his current state of health. But then he would just say, OK, that now let's move on to more sort of interesting things. And then we would talk about science. And he kept that attitude until the bitter end. I mean, 2 days before he passed away, he called me up on the way to the hospital. He says to say, I'm sorry, Christoph, the paper will be delayed because I have to go into hospital. Then in the hospital, he worked on it 2 hours before he passed away. He dictated the last correction to his secretary. So, I mean, he knew he was going to die, but it didn't let him interfere with the serious business of trying to understand the universe, in particular trying to understand how consciousness arises from the brain. I mean, what an attitude to take.
Christoph Koch is the chief scientific officer of the Allen Institute for Brain Science, and he's the author of the book Consciousness, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist. If you'd like to find out more, you'll find a transcript of Steve's interview with Koch that ran in The Atlantic Online on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. Susan Blackmore is a British polymath, a psychologist who's written books on consciousness, memes, and parapsychology. And, as Steve Paulson discovered, she's fascinated by what Zen Buddhism can tell us about the mind. Blackmore says her daily practice of meditation has revealed certain truths that have so far eluded the scientific study of consciousness.
I've been practicing Zen now for more than 30 years. And over the years, my Zen practice began to come together, really, with my intellectual struggles. And it seems to me now that by doing deep meditation and asking difficult questions about consciousness within meditation, one can begin to change in such a way that there doesn't seem any longer to be this separation between self and other, or mental and physical.
You'll have to explain this. Something about the process of Zen meditation itself led you to these insights?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's interesting that from the Zen point of view, and indeed from the point of view of some other forms of Buddhism and Vedanta, Advaita, and other mystical traditions throughout the ages, there are many examples of non-duality. So all of those traditions will say, ultimately, all is one, or you are not separate from the universe. You are the universe. And, you know, all this sounds pretty mystical and weird, doesn't it?
Well, that's easy to say, too, if you are just focusing on your conscious experience. If you don't actually care what science, for instance, says about the brain, sure, that sounds fine. But if you want to actually reconcile the insights of science with that deep understanding of the mind that comes with meditation, it would seem to be still very problematic.
It's extremely problematic. But let me give you an example of the way that I think the meditation has helped me to think about it. When I was teaching my consciousness courses, I used to get my students to really look into their own consciousness. And the way I did that is every week I gave them a question. And they're supposed to ask this question as many times as they could every day. The first question was, am I conscious now? Are you conscious now?
I think I am.
Good. Well, we'll come back to that. But very often, if you just go up to somebody, and which I tend to do, and just poke them and go, hey, are you conscious now? And they go, yes. And get this very strange feeling that something has changed because I asked the question. And you can do it to yourself. And you suddenly think it's almost a bit like waking up, almost a bit like you've just become conscious because you asked the question. Now, that's a clue to think, well, what was happening just before? It's an oddity, one of many, many oddities about consciousness, that whenever I ask the question, am I conscious now? I always am. But what about when I'm not asking the question?
Another way to phrase this might be, are you truly aware right now of what's going on? Are you truly in the moment? When you talk about are you conscious, that's sort of what you mean, right?
Exactly. And so you could say from that point of view, it's very much like mindfulness. Are you here fully in the present with what's going on? But my point is, something happens when you ask that question that led me to then ask my students and myself the second question. Were you conscious a moment ago? And then people are not sure because they have this funny feeling that something had changed or they'd become more conscious. So my next question then was, what was I conscious of a moment ago? And I found this question absolutely fascinating. I mean, several times when I do a retreat, when I'm meditating 6 or 7 hours a day in half-hour sessions with little breaks in between. And once I've done an hour or two, I get really calm, still mind, then kind of let the question, what was I conscious of a moment ago? And what I found is that almost always there are lots and lots of things that I could say I might have been conscious of a moment ago. I can do it now. I can sort of think back. Oh, it's really weird. I just remembered. I just scratched my leg. And I would not have remembered that if I hadn't been asking myself this. But obviously, there's more obvious things like the sound of the humming of the air conditioning. And I know I've been sort of noticing visually my hands because I'm waving my hands like anything as I'm talking. But the weird thing is I can sort of track back these things and they feel as though I was conscious of them. But each didn't have anything to do with the other. Now, the critical thing here is, I don't really know whether I was conscious of them or not. Were there sort of 5 or 6 or 10 me's, one for each of these sort of parallel backward threads? Or was I divided up or are none of them me? Well, if I can't answer the question, then nobody can, because the whole point about consciousness is it's subjective and therefore it's up to me to say. Consciousness is simply an attribution that we make after the fact with our language.
I want to take you back to your Zen practice. And one thing that I find curious is when I was reading how you describe this, you say you actually are not a Buddhist yourself. You practice Zen, but you don't call yourself a Buddhist. Why did Zen hit home for you so profoundly?
Well, go back to the 1970s and imagine me in the end of the hippie era in all my flowing skirts and my, you know, far out man and listening to Grateful Dead and Pink Floyd and taking interesting drugs and all of that stuff. And I had an extraordinary out of the body experience and I was really obsessed with trying to understand the mind. I was studying physiology and psychology at Oxford and that wasn't giving me, it was wonderful and I enjoyed it, but it wasn't giving me answers on those kinds of things. And I went searching and I trained as a witch and I learned to read tarot cards. I did all kinds of stuff. And I became a parapsychologist and looked for paranormal phenomena and never found any. And one of the things that in that whole mishmash of stuff was that I came across a Zen group and started practicing meditation. And all the other things gradually fell by the wayside through my research as well as through my, you know, ordinary life. And the Zen practice was the only thing that survived. And I found it enormously helpful, not just in the kind of intellectual way we're talking about now, but in the whole way of living my life. But the really important thing for me is that when I write about Zen and about meditation and about what I have found, I want people to be clear that I'm not saying this is what the Buddha said or this is what Buddhism says. I'm saying this is what I think I've found through practice that I've been helped through Zen to learn.
Now, you also say that going back to your first extended Zen retreat, I mean, where you sat for hours and hours meditating, that being in the present moment was terrifying.
Yes. It is really hard in the beginning, and it's easier now, but to sit down and just allow the mind to do its stuff because you see the most awful things. I mean, that's the beginning of meditation practice. The first retreat I ever went on, which was 5 days and many, many hours every day meditating, you know, I saw horrific things. The wall would turn into scenes of torture or rape or, you know, awful things like that. Or I'd just be, you know, I just suddenly remember something awful that I'd done and feel mortified and wish I could change it, or something that someone's done to me and I'd feel so angry. And, you know, in meditation, you have to sit there. What the kind of meditation I do, you have to learn to sit with all this stuff and let it be. A lot of it is about letting go and not engaging with stuff, not pushing it away, just letting it be. And you get to know yourself.
So how much do you meditate these days?
Not a lot, but every day. Well, every day I will sit with my husband, if we're both at home, for 15 minutes in the morning. Sometimes I might do half an hour. And I go on retreats once or twice a year when I'll go for a week and do a lot more. So, it varies a lot. But the basis is just that 15 minutes every morning. And I'm sure there are people out there listening and think, yeah, but you should be doing half an hour morning and eat. Well, sorry, I've got a very complex, busy life. And, my advice to anybody would be take on something that you can manage. Because if you do even a little bit every day for years and years and years, I think that has a lot better effect than trying to do too much and failing.
Susan Blackmore, talking with Steve Paulson about her book, Zen and the Art of Consciousness. Want to hear more? You'll find dozens of interviews and transcripts, along with our comic book on consciousness, on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Higher Consciousness, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series was produced by Steve Paulson, with the help of Ann Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. Thanks to the producers of the film Free the Mind for our audio of the classroom meditation. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Meet Your Mind: Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Noor Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
PRI, Public Radio International.